Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Today is our Get Ready for the World Series of Poker show. WSOP begins the end of this month on May 31st and goes through mid-July when the November 9 will be determined. To help us with our show, we have two poker guests. Matt Kaufman, currently a gaming consultant and general manager of a group of affiliate websites. Began his career as a professional poker player, primarily mixed games online, who then went to work in the poker media, primarily as editor of PokerStrategy.com, the largest poker-related website in the world, with over 6 million registered users and the primary forum for non-English poker players, where he broke a lot of the news around full tilt scandal. Rob Stan, he's a Vegas-based poker pro, starting in Foxwoods, and a coach and blogger at CrushLivePoker.com. Primarily plays mid-stakes, no-limit hold'em cash games. Occasionally plays in tournaments, including the main events the last 2 years. Matt, Rob, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
All right, so I'll call them by name each time until we figure out who's who. So we have lots of questions about the World Series poker. Be alternating between the two of you, arbitrarily starting with Matt. Let's talk about what's new and different at the World Series of Poker this year. First, the starting times. Some of them are at 10 a.m. Personally, this strikes me as a bit early for players who often burn the midnight oil. Matt Kaufman, is this good or bad?
I think it's probably a little bit more good than bad, in the sense that I think a lot of the tourists that come out and play a lot of events kind of casually each year, I think the thing that strikes them as off early on, if they go deep in an event, is how late each tournament was running. So I think that, you know, the 10 a.m. start time kind of gives them more room to space things out. There's also table concerns, in the sense that the second tournament that starts each day is going to have more availabilities. You know, if more people are out from the first tournament in the early morning. But yeah, I think the 10 a.m. start times, as much as poker players hate waking up before noon, probably will work themselves out to be a good thing overall, considering you also get to stop earlier in the night.
So they are going to stop sooner. They're going to...
Yeah, well, I mean, the majority of the time, the way that tournaments are structured is based on number of levels played in a given day, as opposed to, you know, actual set time. So if you're going to be playing a certain number of levels each day for each tournament, then the 10 a.m. tournament is definitely going to be finishing earlier off. And then similarly, the later tournament can also get a little bit earlier at the end of the night. I think that it's the 3 and 4 a.m. end times that they're really trying to avoid.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, prize structures. They go deeper this year. 15% of players in the money instead of last year's 10%. Presumably that means the prices are a bit smaller, but they go further. Rob Stan, good or bad?
I definitely think that's a good thing for poker. One of the big complaints that poker had, you know, previous to this was that the payouts were a little bit too top-heavy. When they had like a $10 million guaranteed first place for the main event a few years ago, a lot of people were complaining about that. So anytime you allow more people to cash in a World Series event, I think that's better. And I think 15% is right around the sweet spot. It's obviously going to be a little bit of a flatter payout. So the min cash in the main event last year was $15,000, which is less than double the buy-in of $10,000. But I still think anytime you have, you have more people cashing in an event, that's a good thing for poker because more people are going to be likely to come back and play in future events and future World Series events. So it's a better thing overall.
Also, it's less variance for everybody, right? So these tournaments are huge variance already, and anything that'll lessen that is better, at least for the pros.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. But in some sense, it's a little bit worse because, you know, when you have a $10 million guaranteed first prize, a lot of people will come out and play that might not otherwise play. So there is a negative like aspect to that. So the field could maybe be a little bit tougher with recreational players that would only play for like, you know, the $10 million first prize, for example.
Like a lottery ticket.
Exactly, yes, yes. So less variance is not always, you know, a better thing for the pros because, you know, the recreational players, obviously, they like variance in that sense. So there's good with bad, but overall, I think it's a good thing.
Bigger starting stacks for the 10K events. So it's $50,000 in chips instead of $30,000, although everybody gets 50 instead of 30. So presumably the same blind structure. Matt, good or bad?
I don't really like this one personally. I think that there's kind of a misconception about starting stacks in tournament poker because the more chips you get in the beginning, it just means that the first several levels are more meaningless. You know, it kind of enables players to, they might increase late registrations.
So that means Phil Hellmuth can just skip the first day now?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he, guys like that sort of skip the first day or the first several levels anyway. But I think this kind of will make that even more extreme. And I think that, it's definitely catering to late registrations and the ability to continue to have people entering and not feeling like they're entering with too short of a stack. But like at the same time, I think that when everything is said and done, like at the end of a tournament, regardless of the game, whether you're playing no limit or you're playing a mixed game, you know, where the limit kind of increases, I think that ultimately there's sort of a sweet spot where players start to get aggressive with their chips and that everyone typically kind of waits around until that point anyway to start making significant moves. It might be better off for some of the players that play real well super deep, you know, like cash game, no limit guys might be able to benefit and take a little bit of advantage of this in the early stages. You know, like guys like Rob who are playing 100 plus big blinds deep, you know, on a regular basis for a living. But frankly, you know, when everything really comes down, you know, when the value of chips becomes really significant, I don't think that the starting stack is going to have a huge impact on the play at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Like, obviously the big decisions are made when, you know, the tournament's at like 30, 40 big blinds effective when you get a little bit shorter, but as a cash game player, I mean, I'm obviously all for deeper stacks, and anytime you start with a deeper stack, you know, the edge of the professionals goes up a lot in the beginning. So adding a couple extra levels, it really does benefit the good players over the long run. So for me, for my own personal selfish reasons, I am like a very big fan of the extra starting chips.
Wouldn't it also be good for the civilians? I mean, mightn't they last longer?
Of course, yeah, they're going to get a little bit more play. You know, Matt mentioned that a lot of the bigger decisions are made when, you know, the tournament is 30 or 40 big blinds effective, but I've seen, you know, 300, 400 big blind pots in level two of a tournament, for example. So it's certainly not unheard of. You know, a few years ago in the Monster Stack, I believe you started with maybe 400-ish big blinds, and I had doubled my chip stack in maybe the first 3 hours. So, you know, the first levels are not, you know, they're not completely useless.
Yeah, I also think that part of it is psychological when it comes to, you know, recreational players. You know, people that don't play that often, I feel like they enjoy getting more bang for the buck, quote-unquote, even if it's an artificial thing, because, you know, the feeling of receiving more chips than you would have in previous years for the same money, they feel like they're getting more value, even if they really aren't in terms of the length of time they might actually last.
Oh, so you think they might not last longer than
so
they would have.
They think 50 is more than 30.
Yeah, I mean, they think 50 is more than 30. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, they'll have another couple hours probably on. I mean,
yeah.
You got to figure that the average bust out does happen a little bit later this way.
Right.
Does this make the tournaments last an extra day?
I don't believe so, no.
No, there's no reason for it to. So.
This year, you can register online for the tournament and satellites and maybe even seats to cash games. Rob, good or bad?
I think it's a good thing, obviously, because it makes it easier. You know, now we're in 2016. It's the technological era, so they're coming up with all sorts of ways to make things easier, faster, a little bit more efficient. I don't really have the problem of waiting in line because I only play maybe three or four events, and I usually go very late at night when there is no line. But if I was playing a full schedule, you know, where I'm playing 40 or 50 tournaments, obviously you are going to have to wait in line at some point during the day. So being able to register online and skip, you know, the 1 hour, 2 hour wait times in line, I think is good for those guys. So I do think it's a good thing.
Yeah, I agree, although I also think that it's still never going to get used that much because at the end of the day, like, people want the money in their pocket. They really want to be able to go play whatever cash games they want. I mean, there's obviously going to be people that just have so much money that it doesn't matter to them, but I think most people coming out to the series have sort of a set amount that they're willing to play with or lose over the course of, you know, their weekend in Vegas. You know, the majority of players are really just recreational people from California and elsewhere, and I think that the online registrations, I mean, it's a great thing for the people who want to go about that and, you know, have the money to set aside for all their tournaments ahead of time and still be able to play cash games separately. But I think that people are, I mean, I just don't see it having a huge dent on the lines, in other words. So it's a convenience for those minority of people, but I don't see the lines getting a lot shorter.
Really? That surprises me. I mean, because they're supposed to have an app now, too, that you can do this on your phone, which means you don't have to stand in the line if you can just register on your phone for, I mean, because the lines are a big problem, right?
Right. At the same time, though, they can't accept credit cards. So you can. So, you know, you're still preloading an account with cash. And there's obviously certain advantage, and there's going to be a certain segment of the population that does take advantage of it. But I don't think, because of the lack of credit card acceptance, it's going to be really tough for me to imagine the lines getting a lot shorter because of it.
I see.
Right. Yeah. It's just a convenience for, like, a small group of people that are playing a lot of tournaments and have to do this, you know, maybe once a week where they're having to wait in line, you know, for several hours. So for those guys, I think it's a good thing. But yeah, I don't think it's going to really have an impact on the field.
So I haven't checked this out, but could you go to the cage and just put a deposit of, you know, X amount of dollars and then use it for various signups? Like, for example, let's say you're a sit-and-go player and you just want to play one after another.
Sit-and-goes might be different because it's at a different cage.
Or satellites.
Yeah,
or,
no, but I think for satellites or even just smaller actual WSOP events, you definitely could do that. You could, although I probably would technically be sitting in a WSOP.com account. I imagine that they're not going to have separate accounts that you can just leave money in separate from their online, you know, account.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So I would assume that they'll just be, you know, it is already easy. Last year it was easy to make a deposit in person at the Rio to your WSOP.com account. And anyone listening can, you know, expect to come out and play online in Nevada, whether or not you live here. It's pretty easy to, you know, get set up. You could even play on your phone or something while you're playing another live event. So you could play. You could
that's a real degenerate.
Yeah, you could start multi-tabling live poker.
While you poker.
Yeah.
Really, using your phone at a table is not illegal?
Not unless you're in a hand. So if you're in the middle of a hand, they will get annoyed at you for doing it. But, you know, you could just time out on your cash game table on your phone if you're involved in a pot at the real table.
Yeah, I mean, to be completely honest, they're very lenient when that type of stuff. You know, there's only very few dealers that really, like, enforce that rule to begin with, even though it is the rule. But, yeah.
All right. Yeah, I would think I would want a guy at my live table multi-tabling on his phone.
Yeah, he's paying less attention to stuff that's going on.
It's also less likely to get bored and play bad cards.
Well,
that'd be the counterpoint to that.
That's true.
All right. Now, the World Poker Tour has instituted a 30-second clock in its tournaments. I didn't see that advertised in the World Series of Poker this year. In your opinion, Matt, is a 30-second clock a good idea or an overreaction to a real problem?
I don't know about 30 seconds specifically being a good or a bad idea. I think Rob might have better input on that, but I think that a clock in general is a really good idea. The tanking can get really excessive in certain situations in live tournaments. I feel like anyone who's played even just a few tournaments has seen situations where near the bubble, there's somebody who's got a really short stack, just desperately wants to get into the money, and is just taking their sweet time, knowing they're going to fold, maybe not even looking at their cards, taking 5 minutes to fold just so that the other tables have an opportunity for someone else to bust ahead of them. And, I mean, it's technically it's against the rules, but it's also really difficult to, you know, call someone out for something where you don't really know what they're thinking, because, you know, you're allowed as much time as you want if you're actually thinking about it until someone calls the clock on you right now. So it's kind of a fine line that tournament directors and other players have to deal with as is. And I think a lot of it does get solved with a clock.
Yeah, I think the clock's a great idea. It's probably logistically an issue to implement in the larger tournaments, like the World Series of Poker main event that has, you know, 6,500 people or so. But in the smaller tournaments with smaller fields, and if they were able to implement it in some way, I think it'd be a great thing. Matt mentioned the situation where people are tanking on the bubble unnecessarily. That actually happened to me last year in the main event, where I ended up calling the clock on a guy probably around 10 times in maybe 20 minutes, because every decision is just, you know, tanking.
How can you possibly call the clock 10 times in 20 minutes? He won't have that many turns in 20 minutes.
He will, because every preflop decision, so every hand that's dealt out, you know, he's sitting there and thinking for, you know, 40 seconds to fold, say, 9-deuce offsuit, you know, because he's just completely tanking. It's an artificial thing. He's not actually thinking. He's just purposely delaying to sneak into the money.
But don't you have to wait at least a minute or two before you call the clock?
No. Actually, the floor guy, so obviously the first maybe two or three times, you know, I let it go. But then, you know, after this kept going on, then I realized kind of what the guy was doing. You know, the floor guy was hovering over our table. And then every single time, you know, I would just let the floor guy know. And after maybe two or three times, whatever the rule is, he would just start the countdown, like, right away on the guy. You know, and the clock actually gets shorter as it gets called repeatedly. Well, that was the rule that I saw the guy use last year, where I think it went from a minute to 45 seconds to 30 seconds after multiple times.
You know, I like the online that some of the places had a time bank, you know, where rather than having 30 seconds per, you know, you have certain amount of time in the bank, because sometimes you do have a really difficult decision where 30 seconds is not really enough.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, though, I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find too many spots or too many situations where players are trying to take in some sort of an edge based on calling the clock on another player to make them uncomfortable. I don't think that really happens very often. It'd be kind of unsportsmanlike, and you'd kind of create a bad reputation for yourself, and you're sitting with these people for, you know, some hours and hours at a time. You don't want to piss off everyone that you're, you know, sitting at the table.
I was under the impression with the WPT that it was an automatic thing every...
No, it is. But it's logistically going to... I don't see that ever happening, you know, on a wide, wide scale. But my point was just with respect to calling the clock on other players, you know, in situations where you feel like you don't have enough time in 30 seconds. Most of the time, it's pretty obvious when you're making a real decision.
Yeah.
You know, to other people at the table. They have a concept of how many chips have already gone into the pot, how many chips you have in front of you. And people typically aren't going to be, you know, no one's going to act like a complete jerk just because they want to, you know, sort of rustle your feathers. I've really not seen that much.
Yeah, I also think kind of like the negative stigma that's attached in poker to calling the clock kind of needs to go a little bit, where it's almost like a bad etiquette thing, like Matt mentioned, to call the clock, where, you know, people are repeatedly taking a minute or longer for decisions that don't really need that much thought, you know, for anyone. So I do think we kind of need to get rid of the negative stigma, because a lot of people are scared to call the clock, because when you call the clock, you look like a bad guy. And then I think what has happened is that now we have this tanking epidemic because people are a little bit gun-shy on calling the clock.
What about people? Is this a problem on the TV tables where people deliberately tank just to get more time on television?
Yeah, if you watch the live stream of the main event final table, you know, they broadcast this live. It's basically unwatchable. Even for me as a professional poker player, you know, I like watching these guys play poker, but sitting there and watching guys tank for, you know, a minute for every decision pre-flop, it just basically makes the television unwatchable. And, you know, if you're a player sitting there, you know, it's really like a painful thing. And I understand that it's a big stage, and, you know, obviously these guys are making decisions for hundreds of thousands of dollars sometimes in these televised tournaments. You know, in the main event, it's millions of dollars. So there's nothing wrong with taking your time, but a lot of it is superficial, where guys are taking 10 seconds to fold, you know, 9-deuce offsuit preflop, where there really is no decision to be made. They know what they're going to do right away. And, you know, it's just something that I think kind of needs to be eliminated from poker.
Yeah, I agree.
I remember 35, 40 years ago playing backgammon, and there's this very excellent good player named Dennis Waterman who took forever to make every turn.
and he was an excellent player. I don't think it was tanking. I don't know what he was thinking about, but he was considered one of the best in the world, and it took him a long time to make his play.
He's a big poker player now, actually, but last I saw him anyway, he was playing Pot Limit Omaha. He was quite good. But yeah, backgammon, it's just gotten ridiculous. I know several players who just gave up playing tournament backgammon because the amount of time was ridiculous.
All right. So, Matt, Rob, anything I missed that's different this year from last year that we need to go over?
No, I think we covered mostly everything.
Okay. I'm going to make the assumption that most of our listeners who are going to play in the World Series of Poker have already done so. So we won't be going over first-timer issues. This show will air on 17th of May. We're taping it a bit before that. If it turns out we get several responses to ask us to go over first-timer issues, there's a possibility we can lasso these two guys and put on another show before it starts. All right. Let's look at staking other players. Matt Kaufman, what are the pluses and minuses of being staked?
Well, the pluses of being staked are not putting up your own money and obviously not risking, you know, potentially significant losses, especially if you're going to be playing in fairly high stakes games, and tournaments especially are ridiculously high variance compared to cash games. So there's a lot of players that, you know, might play on their own money most of the year for cash games and then sell action for their tournament events or, you know, seek complete backing for them. The minuses are obviously the opposite of that, which is that when you do really, really well, you're then handing over a large chunk of your profits. It really all comes down to risk reward, what you're going to be playing in, you know, the size of your bankroll. It's just a risk tolerance thing when you're being backed anyway. I think there's a lot more risks and, you know, potential to be scammed involved if you're on the other side of it and you are backing other players.
Yeah, most of those deals that I hear about just seem crazy to me. I don't understand how these people get the backing that they get, but I mean, nice work if you can get it, I guess. But
yeah, it's a little bit of an issue now where people are charging, you know, ridiculous markups on their tournament package. You know, markup being, you know, let's say the World Series of Poker main event is a $10,000 buy-in, so 1% at face value would be $100, but people tend to sell much higher than that. You know, well-known players will sell it like between 130 or, you know, let's just say $120 to $150 for a piece of for a 1% piece in the main event. So basically the excess money there, the extra $50 would go directly to the player. And what ends up happening is that there's a lot of these poker sites that track tournament earnings, okay? They don't track tournament buy-ins. It's not a net number. So if you go on these websites like Hendon Mob or Poker Pages, for example, you would see somebody who has, say, $200,000 in tournament earnings. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're up $200,000. In most cases, it's actually the opposite, where people can have $200,000 in cashes, but they're actually net losers because there's been, let's say, $300,000 or $400,000 in buy-ins. So that's how a lot of these people get sort of lucrative backing deals, because they appear to have made a lot more money than they actually have. And, you know, that's one thing to definitely look out for as an investor, to make sure that the people you're investing in are actually good winning poker players.
Yeah. And even if they are, the price still matters. You know, like somebody's got a 30% genuine 30% lifetime live tournament ROI if they're selling at 1.4, so you're paying, you know, over the 30%, then you're still making a net negative investment, you know, in terms of the expected value of the situation, even though you're putting your money behind a winning player.
Yeah, and that doesn't even take into account the scam factor. I mean,
right.
You know, they're just so many of these guys who, you know, are broke half the time, and, you know, you got to collect, assuming that they even cash.
Yeah, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors in tournament poker, a lot of smoke and mirrors.
There's also something of an epidemic, and because there's a lot of the time where the players who are genuinely really top-notch players, anyone who's a really hardcore poker fan would know some by name, that because of their genuinely amazing results in tournaments, consistently find backers, but have problems away from the table, or, you know, end up sinking away money in the pit, doing all sorts of, you know, recreational gambling on top of the poker, which, you know, they are actually huge winners at in some cases. So you can actually be putting money behind a player, and reputation matters as much or more than, you know, just their pure ability, because there's going to be spots where, you know, a player might genuinely have a 40% lifetime ROI, and you can buy that player at less than a 40% markup, but some percentage of the time the money's going to disappear to the craps table. So, like, you're really desperate. You need to take that into account, because there's so many situations of guys who are huge lifetime winners at poker that are still, you know, in debt, literally millions of dollars to other high-stakes pros.
Yep.
Is it possible or advisable for unknown players to get staked?
It would be very difficult. You know, like I said, you always need some sort of thing, some sort of thing to kind of stand behind. Like Matt said, you know, your reputation means everything. So, you know, if people were to just post on a forum and say, oh, you know, my name is John so-and-so from wherever, you know, I'm looking to play the World Series of Poker, it'd be very difficult for that guy to get staked. So you'd need some sort of reference system and, you know, just some way for people to know who you are, both from a player skill standpoint and, you know, from a trustworthiness standpoint. So I don't think it would be very easy for somebody who's unknown to get staked.
I think that happens, you know, like with Chris Moneymaker, where a bunch of guys in a hometown are going to, you know, their buddy is going to go out and they all agree to take some piece of him, you know. But to have, I mean, I get this question in blackjack a lot about
for $39 or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, he satellited.
No, but he still needed extra money, right? I mean, I thought, didn't his father take a piece and another guy was supposed to take a piece and then didn't come up with the money? And
he may have just sold action at the end just to spread the wealth a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there are certainly going to be situations like that anyway, you know, not necessarily him, but, you know, there's tons of people that just, you know, play in small leagues in their hometown, or they play a once a week, you know, sit and go, and the winner gets to go to the World Series after a course of, you know, several weeks. So there's all sorts of stuff like that going on. And that's not really what we're talking about, in the sense that, you know, if you're selling to your friend that you live next door to, then that's not quite the same situation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know that
yeah.
guy. But yeah, it would be really tough to, you know, go on. I mean, like, the majority of staking happens through 2+2, which is the big poker forum. It's really, really tough to try to get staking on there unless you either have, you know, a pretty good reputation either on the forum or with live players, or, like, really significant online results to back up what you're saying.
Well, yeah, and as I was saying, I get this question in blackjack a lot where people say, you know, I want to find investors to put a bankroll behind me to play blackjack. And you know, at least in blackjack, where I find less leaks of the guys who I really don't know any professional blackjack players who go blow money at craps. Like, that seems to be, or sports betting, that seems to be much more prevalent in poker than in other forms of advantage play. But the guys who are successful blackjack players don't need somebody to stake them. You know what I mean? They have the money
right.
to go stake themselves. So you have to wonder about these guys who are successful, in air quotes there, poker players that are wanting staking. Because as you said, many of them owe millions of dollars to other poker players.
Right, yeah, I would agree with that. There's definitely a lot of kind of shady stuff that goes on with that sort of stuff. It's just like you said, you know, why would somebody need a bankroll? You know, the people who are winning blackjack players don't need a bankroll behind them. And I do think that there's a few tournaments, you know, where that's a little bit of an exception. You know, the main event of the World Series of Poker being probably the biggest one. You know, $10,000 is obviously a lot of money for somebody to put up for one tournament. But I remember there was a guy I played with last year, actually, who I actually Googled because he was on my day two table draw. So I always look up whoever I'm playing with. So I Googled this guy and saw his package that he was selling at, you know, I think 1.4, so a 40% markup, which is a little bit absurd, you know, for him in the main event, because I also saw other packages that he was selling for, like, these $200 tournaments online. So, you know, it's a little bit of a joke in that sense, where it's not really about how good of a poker player you are, it's about how good of a salesman you are.
Yeah.
What was his markup? What was he asking for the 111,000 one drop tournament?
I think he set that one out there.
Yeah. Okay. So, let's look at cash games while the World Series of Poker is going on. Matt, are the players in town for the World Series of Poker better or worse in general than regular Vegas players?
They're a lot worse. And just on average, they're much, much worse, because there's so many players that come out and you know, this is the one time of the year that some of these guys play. Whereas Vegas locals, even recreational players, typically have access to games. You know, they can drive over to whatever station's casino is nearest to their home and, you know, play casually whenever they feel like, basically. Yeah, it's a really, really good opportunity for good players to, you know, make a lot of money over the course of, you know, June.
Yeah, I mean, agree with that completely. I actually have heard a lot of Vegas locals say that the games get tougher because obviously with the massive influx of recreational players, also anybody who's a professional poker player is usually in Vegas for that 6 weeks. So there is an influx of recreational players, which makes the, make the game better and, you know, a little bit more profitable. But you're also going to find yourself playing against really good players. You know, I've found myself in a lot of games where I look around and it's like me and, you know, seven kids from Europe that are online players that are very good. So there is a little bit of a mix, and I've, like I said, I've heard from a lot of Vegas locals that actually don't like the series games. So even though myself personally, I do think that they get a lot better, there are some people in Vegas that don't really like the series games.
So when you go out during June, do you prefer to go play at the Rio in those games, or do you find that the games in your home, wherever you normally play, the Bellagio or Aria or whatever, Do you find those games get better as well?
Yeah, the games get better everywhere. I usually don't play that much cash at the Rio, mostly for other reasons. It doesn't really have anything to do with the games. You know, the games at the Rio are certainly fine. The games are good everywhere. But the reason that I don't like playing at the Rio is because it's just genuinely like a poorly run casino. I think the dealers are very bad. There's not really that many good places to eat. You know, the chairs are bad. You know, so I have complaints like... away from the poker game. So I typically play at, you know, my normal place, like, let's say, Venetian or Bellagio, as opposed to playing cash at the Rio.
Yeah, how about you, Matt? Where are the best places to play cash?
I typically don't play No Limit, so I am basically forced to play either at the Rio or the Bellagio as a mixed game player. So I pretty much hang out at the Rio all the time because for the games that I'm playing, which is probably primarily going to be between like 20, 40, and 50, 100 limit games, you know, Omaha 8 or better in mixed games, that's really the only place that they are. Whereas if you're a no limit player between, you know, really for any stakes, there's a whole host of places you can find a ton of games during the summer out here. The dealer thing is actually an interesting reason not to play at the Rio, though. I feel like a lot of people don't take the dealers into consideration enough when choosing where to play. I know for sure that if I was playing a game that ran elsewhere, I would probably also get out of the Rio. Some of the worst dealer mistakes that you will have ever heard of in your life. I'll tell a real quick story. 2 years ago, my friend Mark was playing in a daily deep stack at the Rio and witnessed a player raise from early position, a player in later position toss out a single chip, which usually it's that's how you can call, or it's what you're signaling to the dealer anyway. And then the player in early position reaches out and removes all of the chips except for that single chip to match the decrease in raise. It's the only time in the history of tournament poker where players successfully decreased the size of a previous bet. And the dealer peeled and dealed. Like there are dealers that are just out there clueless. There are way, way, way more games than there are tables. And I'm sorry, than there are competent dealers, especially in June. And I mean, that's a really great reason to play at the Bellagio or the Aria or the Venetian, which, you know, have a fairly sizable staff year-round because they're used to hosting, you know, bigger tournaments occasionally in times of the year that aren't June.
My game is video poker, and I know how to get comps at video poker. Is there ways to get comps at live poker? And does that vary during the World Series?
Yeah, well, if you're planning on playing at Rio, you know, tipping is always encouraged anywhere in Las Vegas. So
buy a comp.
Well, you can buy the comp at a discount, you know. So there's a lot of floor guys at Rio. And, you know, if you're there for any amount of time, just try to kind of be nice to these guys and make sure they know you. And, you know, they'll give you, like, a $10 food comp. You know, I believe the comps they give you are $10. So just kind of be friendly to those guys, and if they see you playing, you know, when I'm at Rio, I have played a little bit of cash at Rio, you know, usually playing 5-10, it's very easy, you know, just tell them that you're playing right there and they'll give you a comp. And then when the floor guys switch, you can go to a different floor guy, get a different comp, you know, this is just for Rio. So basically when I'm at the Rio, I eat completely for free, you know, $50 steaks every time I'm there.
You can use 5 of these $10 coupons.
Yeah, you can accumulate them. Yep. Yeah, there's no limit on that at all. And separately from that, when you enter a tournament, they put a certain amount of cash on your total rewards card, which, you know, essentially operates as cash within the Rio. So if you're playing, especially, you know, bracelet events where the buy-in is fairly sizable, you do get it's not a high percentage in terms of comps, but, you know, if you're playing a bunch of 1500 or, you know, even 5K or 10K events, certainly the small percentage is going to add up in terms of meals.
Now, what about your play with Bellagio or Venetian or whatever? Do you earn comps there?
You do, yeah, but there's no food tickets there. I just felt like it was necessary to mention the food tickets because that's kind of like a unique thing to Rio. Obviously, any of the main casinos in Vegas will offer you Venetian is $1, Wynn is $1.50, and then everywhere else, I think the M Life properties, Bellagio and Aria, is $2 an hour for food. But that's the same as it is year-round, so that's nothing specific to the World Series of Poker like the food coupons are.
Hmm.
Yeah, I guess additionally this year we got to take into account, some people would have to take into account the parking situation at MGM properties.
Yeah, very true. They'll be charging for parking while the series is going on, which is a little bit unfortunate.
Oh, is that, I mean, I know they've been talking about it, but it hasn't started yet. Are
I think
they
it
going
went
to?
Into effect recently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And nope,
all
not yet.
All MGM properties or just MGM Grand?
Then no. It's going to be all MGM properties for sure. I think it started recently, maybe just for big events then. I know that they have the system in place to do it now.
Yeah, there's actually signs up in the parking garage right now that say, like, oh, don't forget your parking ticket or whatever. But I believe it's going to be June 1st that they start that. I was at Bellagio yesterday, and there was no charge for parking for anyone there. But it will be by the series.
Oh, but so you can play May 31st with free parking. Coaching. One of you is a coach. Rob. Assuming our listeners are hearing this on May 17th, is it too late to receive coaching for this year's event?
No, definitely not. First off, I'll preface this. I actually did a podcast about this on Crush Live Poker the other day, where I think unless you're already a professional poker player or very close to a professional poker player, I don't think that one-on-one coaching is really the right way for people to go with that. I'd highly recommend either posting hands on forums or, you know, joining one of the bigger training sites. I think that's a much more cost effective, like, bang for the buck for people who aren't already professional poker players. But, you know, for people out there who already are professional poker players and are looking to get coaching, let's say tournament specific coaching, no, it's definitely not too late. Yeah, you can definitely go out and get tournament coaching. There's a ton of good tournament coaches where you can go and find. So, no, it's definitely not too late.
What types of coaching are especially useful for tournaments as opposed to cash games?
Okay, well, for me, obviously I'm a cash game player, so the stack depth in tournaments tends to be a lot different. So since I'm only playing, you know, let's say 3 or 4 tournaments a year, I always like to brush up on playing 30 big blinds effective, because obviously when you're that short, your strategy is going to be much different than when you're, let's say, 100 or 200 or 300 big blinds effective, which is usually what I'm playing in cash games. There's also, you know, I won't get too much in detail into something that's called ICM, the independent chip model, which basically has to do with, you know, the tournament payouts. That's also something that, you know, I like brushing up on before the World Series of Poker starts, because, you know, it's only something that I deal with, you know, only this time of the year, you know, because this is the only time that I'm playing tournaments.
Yeah, I think ICM calculations are kind of a good thing just to get familiar with, even if you're not going to, you know, study them up. Just the concepts, generally speaking, I think Rob might correct me, but I think the biggest concept from that is just the value of tournaments decrease as you accumulate them. The value of chips decrease as you accumulate them, especially early on in an event. And later in an event, you know, you can have, there's ICM calculators that you can download for your phone. Even, you know, where you can determine the rough value of your chips relative to the prize pool. So you can, late in the tournament, see there's a $120,000, you know, prize pool that's going to be distributed among 30, 40, 50 players, however many it is. You can put in your, you know, number of chips, the total number of chips in the tournament, and you can hear exactly the number of what your chips are currently worth.
If you're an average player.
Yeah, it's just you fill in the information. Your phone spits out the answer for you. Right, and that is assuming you're an average player. So obviously, but if you're superior to the field, your number would increase.
But how does that help you other than if you were in a situation where you're trying to make a deal?
Well, I think the biggest spot that it helps you is trying to compare. It's a risk-taking thing. So when the next payouts in an event are relatively small jumps in terms of the money, maybe it incentivizes you to take more risks in order to gain a bigger stack. And on the flip side, if the next individual payouts are significant jumps, like if you bust now, it's worth 10,000, and if you bust two players out from now, it's worth 20. That's obviously a huge implication on sort of the safety and the precaution you should take with your stack.
Right. It's also a good thing to really be aware, especially if you get deep in a tournament where, the payouts just start getting so large, even into like the six figures, let's say, when there's like, seven or eight players left in a tournament. It's also really good to be aware of the other player's stack. So let's say if you're second in chips, you really don't want to be tangling with the person who's first in chips if there's, say, two or three short stacks behind you that are likely to bust soon. And, you're going to improve your cash by several hundred thousands of dollars.
Sure.
Now, every coach has a different point of view and emphasizes different things. Still, hearing more than one voice can be beneficial, too. Where's the sweet spot in the one guru or 10 approach?
Well, I'm a very big advocate of listening to as many different people as you possibly can. I think in poker, a lot of people kind of put themselves in a little box where they think, okay, this is the correct way to play. This is how I'm going to do this. This is the way I always do this. And they don't really challenge their thinking and make efforts to improve because they think they either have everything figured out and, this is the way that I'm going to play. So I'm a very big advocate of listening to as many voices as you possibly can. Even me, with the people that I coach, there's a lot of things that I talk to them about, and they provide kind of different viewpoints that maybe I haven't even considered. So if you look at it from the perspective of, who's the better poker player, me or them, obviously I think it's me. But, of course that doesn't mean that there's nothing to be learned and everything that I say is correct and everything that they say is wrong. Actually when I deal with my students, the first thing that I tell them is, please don't be shy about saying, look, I disagree with you on this and here are my reasons why. Okay, because you can't get yourself in a situation where you think everything that this guy says or everything that I say is completely correct and, everything else is just a waste of time. So definitely be as open as possible.
Yeah. You also never know where you'll pick stuff up from. Like, there you can sometimes, not learn anything for a long time and then hear something completely random or in a source that you wouldn't expect to, and it makes you rethink your strategy related to something specific. Like, I know years ago, like when I was playing online almost exclusively, I had very specific bet sizing tendencies because online everyone sees your exact bet size, it's labeled for them. So they can, immediately do the calculations relative to the pot. You can't really take too much advantage of good players by, betting bigger or smaller. I mean, you can, but in terms of the situations I'm talking about, there's kind of, there's often optimum sizes where live, people have a difficult time looking at the number of chips in the pot. So like there's just a random, Gus Hansen is a, I guess, former backgammon pro also, who wrote a book called Every Hand Revealed, which I feel like no one talks about. Some people like the book, but I think most people that are, serious pros don't consider this like an influence in any way. But for some reason, to me, it clicked early on in that book when I was reading it, where he says that he typically bets bigger for value and smaller when he's bluffing, and he feels that live players just don't notice. And I've found that to be basically the same thing as well. There are things where I would take a more analytical approach online because everyone was good and everyone was seeing exactly the chip sizing, the bet sizing. Whereas live, I wasn't taking advantage of the kind of human element and the inaccuracies of just someone seeing a bunch of chips in the middle of a table.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Okay, we have some more questions for him. We have one final question before the commercial break, and then we're going to have some more after. And that is that you guys are both going to be in the main event this year. Yep. Have you picked the coach you're going to use once you reach the November 9th?
I don't think Matt's going to play this year, but...
Oh, so you don't have to pick a coach.
Yeah, maybe I'll pick Matt Coffin as my coach. Now, if I was to make the November 9, I'm actually a really big fan of Scott Siever. I know he actually has some mutual friends of mine, so if I did, you know, kind of hit the lottery in that way and make the November 9, I think Scott Seaver would probably be a good choice for me as a coach. I really have a lot of respect for his game and think he'd be a good coach.
Scott's a great guy, too. He's just a really nice person.
So South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. The big promotion in May is the $500,000 swipe, spin, and win. You play $300 coin in on video poker Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Spin the virtual wheel. Low-end prizes are 2,500 points or $7.50. Mystery gift. Well, you know what casino gifts are. And the lunch buffet. The highest gifts are $25 and $50 of free play. The next double point day is Memorial Day, Monday, May 30th, midnight to midnight, no limits. For those of you so inclined, penny slots earn 10 times points that day, and other reels earn 5 times points. They have free senior slot tournaments on Thursdays, where more than $5,000 in free play is given away weekly. At the Palms, from now until May 13th, they have drawings. Well, this is going to be done on May 17th, so let me rephrase this. Between until the end of the month, from May 16th to 27th, you can earn gift cards to Costco. Gift cards are earned at a rate of 0.2%, up to $190 per day. You keep the points. In May, every Sunday, you earn double points on video poker and 10 times points on reels and video reels. No limits. They have drawings every Saturday night, 7 o'clock. You do not have to be present to win. Winners share $10,000 in prizes, but you must collect them before midnight or they evaporate. VideoPoker.com is the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the games, including Quick Quads, which is my personal favorite game. For games of this equal EV, I will go to Quick Quads if I can. They have a game of the week, but it has not yet been announced, given that we are hosting this show, we're taping this show 1 week before it airs. All right, so let's go back to our guest, Matt Kaufman and Rob Stan. Full Tilt Poker. There was a scandal a couple of years ago. It's been bought out by PokerStars. Scandal there too. But now the Full Tilt platform is disappearing. And so you have to use PokerStars platform. Is this a big deal?
I think it's less of a deal than some people are going to make of it, in the sense that I don't think that there's too many players. I mean, it's really only the most serious of online pros that are, you know, playing at huge volume at both sites. I think the majority of recreational players pick one or the other and stick to it overwhelmingly. Maybe not for, you know, some of the bigger tournaments. I'm sure there are guys, you know, play PokerStars for WCOOP, which is the World Championship of Online Poker, even if they're, you know, primarily Full Tilt players otherwise. But I think that the interesting thing from a business perspective is that the Full Tilt platform is going to be unused and an extremely valuable asset to someone. It'll be kind of interesting from my perspective, you know, on the business side of poker, to see what Amaya does with it. It's potentially, you know, worth tens and tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds if you include the value of the brand itself. And it's an interesting situation that they're going to be in, because they either have to do something with it internally, which would obviously be getting rid of the software, which would be a huge waste, or if they choose to sell it, then they're kind of inviting a competitor into the game with a really competent and kind of a really well-built piece of software. So I'm going to be very interested to see how they proceed, because I think obviously there's operational costs that they get to save, but it's going to be really interesting to me to see what they do with Full Tilt.
If they had to retire one of the softwares, are they retiring the right one?
Yeah, definitely they're retiring the right one. I mean, the PokerStars software is kind of second to none, including Full Tilt. And frankly, the Full Tilt software is second to none relative to everything else out there. So they own the best and the second best piece of software by virtually any metric, you know, in terms of responsiveness, ability for their servers to, you know, withstand a really, really heavy load for huge tournaments. Basically any metric, the PokerStars software is the best there is out there. So it's kind of an odd situation for them to be scrapping the second place software when their biggest competitors are, you know, going to be using software that's inferior to the one that they're scrapping.
Interesting.
All right. Rob, you're coach or blogger at CrushLifePoker.com. What is that all about?
CrushLife Poker is an online training site started by Bart Hansen. I think they're most of the guys there are based in LA. You know, it started in LA, and I actually just recently started there, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. I have a podcast that comes out the first and third Saturday of every month. If you guys wanted to get a free month at Crush Live Poker, you can use the code RFA305.
RFA, that's not gambling with an edge. RFA305, what does that stand for?
That's just my affiliate code. So anybody listening to this who wanted to hear my podcast, it comes out the first and third Saturday of every month, RFA305.
And on your podcast, do you have a guest each episode, or it's just you sort of talking about kind of coaching, but without a student there?
Right, yeah, it's just me. There's no guests. I might have some guests eventually on the show, but typically there's no guests. I actually talk about a lot of the intangible things in live poker, you know, specific things to live poker that maybe a lot of like online guys aren't really specific with, kind of like dealing with recreational players, you know, managing your bankroll, managing till, a lot of topics like that that aren't necessarily poker strategy related in terms of like X's and O's.
Very good. So we've been talking to Matt Kaufman and Rob Stand. It's primarily get ready for World Series of Poker Week. Thank you both, gentlemen. Richard, how do people hear our old...
First of all, we welcome people's questions. You can send them to us at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com or facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge. Or you can tweet them at us at RWM21. You can sign up to get the show delivered to you automatically every week at iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or my site, richardmunchkin.com. And for an archive of all the old episodes, you can find those at bobdancer.com.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Matt. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.